From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The experience of Kevin Kling is one of those pitches you make during a public radio fund drive about how radio is so intimate and how the characters you hear become friends or acquaintances. Kling is a humorist from Minnesota, and most of us came to know him through the stories he would tell from back home on NPR's All Things Considered. The stories were funny and charming, but they changed a little after Kevin was seriously injured in a motorcycle accident in 2001. As a listener, you worried about the guy, but his commentaries always reassured us as he talked about the surgeries and about the comically tragic experience of losing the use of his arm. Today in the program, we're talking with Kevin Kling about, well, when you're with a storyteller, there's always something to talk about. So join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It has to be true that most every place has a storytelling tradition, but there are those places that, for some reason, the people are just particularly good at it. Could be the weather, like the steamy heat of the South or the frigid cold of the North. And this is where Kevin Kling is from. Of course, if you listen to public radio, you already know that. For years, Kevin has told us all kinds of stories about his home in Minnesota as a commentator on All Things Considered. So we know about his uncles and his dogs and how he learned to stuff a chipmunk. We also know what it was like when he was almost killed in a motorcycle accident in 2001. He used those stories to explain to us what was happening, but also as a way to heal. Today in the program, we're talking with Kevin Kling about stories and other things. Kevin Kling is a humorist. He's a playwright based in Minneapolis. Over the years, his work has been heard on National Public Radio's All Things Considered, as I said. He's published two collections of stories, The Dog Says How and most recently Holiday Inn. He also has a children's book. We'll talk about that as we go along. And Kevin Kling, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks, Doug.
Well, I guess I wanted to start with where the stories came from. And I mentioned there at the beginning, you know, it has to have something to do with place.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's true?
I do. I think, too, if you grow up around storytellers, I mean, my brother actually is a great storyteller. And I had to stop putting intermissions in shows because they'd be laughing harder in the lobby. And I go, okay, that does it. even in college, you found out early your night before was only as good as your ability to tell about it.
Yeah.
So my buddies are just great storytellers. And I didn't really know I was destined to this occupation. And I was at a party. You know, you're always in the kitchen is like the best place for a party. And I was in there and just blabbing away. And a producer was in there, a theater producer. And she said, do you want to do that on stage? And I said, what? And she goes, just what you did in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. And so that just launched this amazing, wonderful career. And then I luckily got in on NPR, which is then it flowered.
Yeah. Yeah, I heard you say this. You once said artists find what they don't find what they do. They recognize what they're doing.
I think that's true. Yeah. I think that people ask, you know, when did you know you were a storyteller? And it's in retrospect.
Yeah.
It's always there. And I think it also comes with a person. I remember seeing a guy, John Spellman, and I saw him in Sweden, and he was telling Vietnam stories. And they were really heart-wrenching, beautiful stories, and I didn't know you could really go there. I thought storytelling was more entertainment, and this really had such a beautiful value to it. And I didn't just want to be a storyteller. I wanted to be him.
Yeah.
And I think that that's another thing. When you really not only want to be that occupation, but the person you're seeing or being with, that's a clue.
Yeah. I wonder if you've said that that we're all drawn to a geography.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think we all have a place, you know, like that we're not that we're just drawn to, but that we feel a kind of connection to?
I do. John O'Donohue speaks to this just beautifully, the Celtic monk who recently passed away. And he said that if we come from clay, what kind of clay did you come from? A craggy cliff or a peaceful meadow? And that kind of clay really determines your characteristics. And I think that also really goes into play when you meet someone that is your soulmate, when you meet your bride-to-be, and you go, man, we've known each other, and you're possibly from the same clay. And I love he takes it a step further, that we have an inner landscape and an outer landscape, that inner landscape is how we perceive ourselves and the outer landscape is how we're perceived by others. Mm. And I think one of the beauties of storytelling is the ability to traverse landscapes, to go back and forth and to expose some of those inner landscapes.
So you're like, let's take your brother.
No, please.
All right. So now, of course, he's taking up all the oxygen in the room like he always does. Right?
Yeah.
So what made him great? I know what makes you good, and we'll talk about your storytelling. But what makes him good? Is it like there's an arc that he has?
My brother has the joie de vivre. His joie at the expense of your de vivre.
Okay.
It's like he is the wildest guy. And I mean, if you can tag along with him, something's going to happen. It always does.
Yeah.
And so just being around him, it was, I mean, we're going to Ireland next month. Oh man, my whole family. And my brother never leaves Minnesota. He never leaves it. Cause it's like, he goes, if I was to go somewhere, it'd be here. You know, he says, if I was to go on vacation, it'd be where I live. So he never leaves. So my family's going to find our roots in Ireland. And there's going to be, if we survive, some great stories.
Well, maybe there's the clue then. It's because it seems like, cause storytellers always have experiences. There's always something weird that happened to them, and it's because they take risks, right? Or it's because why is that?
I think it's recognizing it. I think you know, you have the trip you plan, and then you have the trip you take.
Right.
You know, so you get this trip all planned, and then you go, and it never is what you planned. But I think it's what a storyteller does is go back to what you planned. And then the trip you take, and you find these threads that run through the trip. And it doesn't have to be a physical journey. It can be any kind of a journey.
Right.
And these patterns develop. It's like the chaos theory. In retrospect, chaos has patterns. And it's the same thing in a story. And you get to the end and you go, how did that happen to us? And you know what? It happened the day you decided to go on this trip.
Yeah.
And so you can – and a story is the same way. You go back and you find those patterns, and there it is.
So I want to ask you about one pretty distinct element of home, and that is the way you speak.
Mm-hmm.
You said once that when you leave, your accent probably gets stronger.
I do. It does.
And so let's talk about that dialect, because I have to say most of us who listen to All Things Considered for any amount of time learn to speak Minnesotan through you, through one of your essays. And you have this way of teaching people to speak like a Minnesotan.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
Yeah. I ain't going to pay no dollar for a corn muffin that's half dough.
Right. Yeah, that does it. It's like the rain in Spain falls mainly on the plain. That's the Minnesota quintessential sentence. Yeah. If you can nail that, you can walk among us. Yeah, that's the sentence. But the other one is Fargo. People – and they really stretched it in Fargo. And
yeah,
I've got a lot of buddies in that. But I do have to say I still – when you're in Minnesota and when that movie came out – people were calling the radio station and they're going, hey, what's the deal? We don't sound like that. You guys are killing it. No.
There's this story you talk about when you were living in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk about how it was like peaceful, like there's like this sense of paradise. And you talk about how you wanted to stay there.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
you really wanted to be there. But part of the thing was that you couldn't go through with it because you say this in the book. You say because you need tension.
Right.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that?
I didn't know it at the time, but I do need a sense of tension in my life. I need and might be having to do with being an artist, because to be honest, nobody's an artist on purpose. You would never do it on purpose. There's something that's driving you, something that you need to bring to the world.
Mm.
That you think either through a personal sense or through a community sense that it will make the world better. And that's what happened with the tension. And part of that tension, part of that story is too, I found out early that actually I'm the kind of guy that wears socks with sandals because I know it ticks people off. And it's that same deal. It's like for some reason in my life, I do find that thing that will put a little bit of sand in the situation, you know, that I enjoy the abrasion. I enjoy the irony and the paradoxes in our worlds. And I was missing that in Australia, in that sense of peace. But I still love Australia. If you can ever go there, you got to go there.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
But it was just like, but too perfect in some way?
You know, I found that after a while the piece was disconcerting. And this woman named Ray wanted to marry me so that I could stay there. And I'd met her that morning and she's like, I don't care, I'll marry you. So I was going to marry Ray, but then I just bailed. I said, Ray, I can't do it. Oh, and I don't know if this is even in the book, but she was really into TV. She watched like 15 hours of TV a day. So our engagement ring, I went to a thrift store and I bought an old TV and I glued a little ring on it. And her engagement ring was a TV with a ring glued on it. And she like wept.
I want to ask you about your left arm.
Mm-hmm.
You have a congenital birth defect, and you talk about this in your pieces. I mean, you used to call it Scarlett O'Hara.
Right.
Your arm. But there's this thing where you write about when you were a kid, how you say that people made assumptions about you because of the arm, and you could kind of tell who they blamed for your condition by the words they chose when they mm-hmm. asked you about it. Did you talk about that?
You've done some work here because this is – you're right on the – I think you're right on the heart of why I tell stories. Early on when you're born with a disability, you're already seeing life through a spectrum. And you're already – people talk to you and refer to you in a different way, and you can already tell by the way they refer to and talk to other people. And so by the words people chose, I really became interested and involved with words and rhetoric, started trafficking in the alphabet, as I say, because when people would refer to my arm, they always would choose a certain word. And by that word, they would give away a lot about themselves. And when they did that, I could use that to get what I needed from them. And it's like when you're a kid, you'll take any angle you can get. And so I learned early through rhetoric, through the word use, to read people faster. And it's not something you do on purpose as a kid. It's a survival mechanism.
Yeah. And it's not just manipulation. It's no, more than that. Or is it?
It is.
It is that.
I want to say it's more. Because you want a higher purpose.
Make it
for
noble,
yourself.
But yeah. It's not, right?
No, you're trying to get stuff and you're trying to beat your brother to it, you know? And I would do anything. My parents, I'm still mad at them. They never took favoritism on my behalf. Because I would use, you know, you're using any card you can. And I'd play the disability card and they never went with it. You know, they treated us as equals, which in the long run really paid off. But at the time, I was really hoping to get the edge on him. But I know that I'm a storyteller because of my disability.
Huh. What is the – is there a relationship to the disability and the fact that you and your brother, probably your whole family, did stupid things all the time or crazy things?
No, we were going to do that anyway.
Is that right?
Yeah. No, that was destined. That was – it is kind of genetic. My nephews, I look at them, I just want to weep. They're going right down the same tunnel. And there is something. My dad was pretty wild too. Around 28, we wise up. But before that, there's something not hardening in the
So if you can live to 28, you're going to be all right.
Pretty much. Yeah. You'll be dinged up. But yep. But there is something. There's this wanderlust. There's this thing that does really – but you know what? And I talk about this a bit in the book as well about – or I might. There's a genetic in Americans. It's called the long gene, and it's a genetic condition they found in Americans more than anywhere else in the world. And it's found in explorers and adventurers. As I say, the whatever happened to is in their high school reunions, whose last words were "Watch this" or "What's this do?" So it is a genetic condition that we're presupposed to. And it's the guys who settled this country. You know, it's people that had the gumption to face the unknown for a better life. And we still carry some of that.
Like, what's the inclination then? Maybe that explains it. For you and your brother to go out in some field and for him to shoot an arrow straight above you into the air.
Yeah, just to see. I mean, the one that cracked me up, this isn't in a book yet, but I was just thinking of this the other day. When we were little, my brother was pushing me down a hill in the wagon. Yeah. I'm in the wagon, and he's pushing me right toward the house. And we're going right toward the house, and he knows and I know it. But we're heading for the house. So I look at the house, and I go, okay, if I hit that concrete, that's going to hurt. But that window, I know they give. I've seen this on TV. So I aim for the window. So my brother's pushing me right for this window. What does he do? he hops in the wagon because he doesn't want me to go through it without him. And so we both go through the window. He could have just shoved me through it, but that's his brain, you know, going, I'm not missing this.
Kevin Kling is with us. His books are The Dog Says How and Holiday Inn, his new children's book, Big Little Brother. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Kevin Kling is with us, storyteller. And I don't mean storyteller like filmmaker or writer or musician, though he does a lot of that stuff as well. Kevin Kling gets up on a stage or gets on the radio and tells stories. Let's take a call from Nathan. He's in Provo. Nathan, welcome.
I'm wondering what percentage is of your stories are directly from your life? What percentage is your imagination? David Sedaris, he says that, you know, his books are like, you know, his life, but, you know, and then some, you know, they're mm-hmm. entertainment, but he does yeah. take it from his life. What percentage is that for you? And the second part of the question is, what is the difference in your mind between the oral tradition and your books? Is it as simple as simply not being able to put more information in a book? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Those are both great questions. I'm not a stickler for I love David Sedaris. I don't care how he gets where he gets. I just think he's a brilliant writer. My stuff, it tends to be about 97 to 99% true, just because the truth seems to blow my mind more than anything I can make up. And so what I'll do, though, often is I will compress time. So a lot of times the facts are what happened, but they might be weeks or years apart, and I'll squeeze the time. But by and large, the stuff that I write is true. Your second part of your question is really – that's such an important thing. The oral tradition, most of my work, in fact, the two books were created through the oral tradition, telling and retelling and retelling. Homer, the Odyssey, is a wonderful example of a piece created through hundreds of years of retelling. And you can tell when you read it, it reads okay. But if you've ever heard the Odyssey, mm-hmm. the narrative forms and the way they switch and the way people are called, the epithets, and it's just – amazing when you hear it. And so these pieces really are designed to be told through the oral tradition. Mark Twain writes a wonderful piece. He writes a story how he tells it, and he writes it as he writes it. And they're almost two completely different pieces. Because when you tell a story, there's so many things at play. There's the pace. There's your vocal pitch. There's, you know, when you say, I caught a fish this big, you better explain that if it's in a book. But if you're telling it in front of people, you can really let them know. And so it is really two different art forms. So sometimes I bristle when somebody's a storyteller, it's really a visceral art form. When somebody's an author, that's a whole different game, and I have a great deal of respect for both fields.
You know, I've heard you explain that, you know, in some art forms, the way the energy is distributed in a performance can mm-hmm. be different. You say when you're telling a story, like 100% of that energy is an exchange.
Yes, it is. It's a conversation.
Yeah.
Granted, a pretty much a one-sided one, but it still is, and you're really reading an audience, and they will clue you in. They'll tell you which way to go with your story, and then either you take them where they want to go or where they don't want to go, which is really where they really want to go.
Yeah.
And so you really use what the clues people give you, as you would sitting in a coffee shop across the table from somebody. You know, you really pick up, you know, how your friend is taking in your story. It's really a wonderful organic form. I'm just such a fan of storytelling. Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Glad you called. Thanks very much. So, why did you get a motorcycle?
Oh man, I just love those things. like I always wanted to fly.
Yeah.
And it was a form of flying. It's kinetic mobility, you know. When you, a motorcycle, if you stand up, it'll fall over. But so it requires movement. It requires flight to keep up, to keep moving. And that feeling was unlike anything. And then I really got into rebuilding antique bikes. So I still have a garage full of iron, you know, all this old metal that I just loved rebuilding antique motorcycles and then riding them.
You write in the book, it's like a poem almost or an essay about how you – that sense of flight and riding in the morning. And you talk about the experience of riding in the morning.
Mm-hmm. Like as the earth trembles to life. Yeah. And you're riding along and you do feel bird-like. And then, you know, if you're riding with a bunch of guys, it feels like a flock. And because you're all banking the same way and you're all turning. I mean, it reminded me of really does of the barn swallows in my grandparents' farm when I would watch them make these unbelievable banking maneuvers. Yeah. So that really caught hold. And yeah, I miss it. I plan on trying to get back on one.
Really?
Don't tell my mom. Okay. I said, oh, man.
Well, there's this story when you talk about that. It's a way of getting into the – describing the accident. And you say when you hit the brakes, from your body you flew,
mm-hmm.
which is this kind of, you know, ironic kind of tragic image when you're flying through the air in this accident. But did you really think of it as flying? Do you know what I mean? Do you remember it in that way or is that
– I think that's about the closest way I can think of. There's no way to describe this. It was where – I don't know exactly where I went, but it's a very common thing in people that have come back from a near-death experience, this amazing sense of peace that you're headed toward. And for a lot of people, you either get to choose to go to that peace or to come back to this plane of existence. Mm-hmm. And I actually did have it felt like a choice that I came
like
back.
Like you could choose this thing or the other
yep.
thing.
Yep. And neither one seemed wrong. It didn't seem like, oh, no, I need to come back. It didn't seem like that at all. Mm-hmm. It seemed like both choices were correct. And so something in that, and I think this is one of the reasons why my work changed, as you indicated early, is that I came back for a reason. I believe I'm still figuring out what that is. I mean – finding which side of the calamity the reason sits. Is it to atone or to learn? I'm still wondering about that. But on one side or the other, there's a reason that I need to address while I had came back for.
I wonder, we should probably say just how bad it was, the accident. I mean, there's a nurse who told you that you basically used your face as an airbag.
Yeah. That's why she said I could still think. She said, you're lucky you used your head used your face as an airbag. That's why you still have your thoughts. And I was in that room. They told me at the hospital that I was in the room that not a lot of folks come out of. So I was really lucky. And I do feel really lucky.
You, of course, had been a commentator for All Things Considered, I mean, before the accident. And I remember when it happened, and I remember, like, as a listening community, people you'd talk to,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's a what's happened to him? What's going on? And I wanted to play an excerpt. This is kind of an extended excerpt of a piece that aired when you returned to the air, Kevin, a piece in January of 2002. And how it played out on the radio, because I think what's interesting to me was that, like, you weren't just this person that we're worried about you. We were wondering what you were going to sound like now and how mm-hmm. this was going, because we knew it was bad,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
Can you remember writing this piece, or can you remember putting this piece together?
Just barely. I tell you, I was pretty in and out of reality. Was really up for grabs for a while. I was in a theater company for a while, Interact in Minneapolis. It's a wonderful company, folks, actors with disabilities. And I'd be on stage and all of a sudden I'd look out and I'd go, uh-oh, there's a lot of people looking at me for some reason. I bet I'm in a play.
Wow.
And then I'd try to figure out where I was. And I'd look over the guy next to me and he's looking at me with the same look on his face that I'm looking at him. And we're both up there trying to figure out where we are. So luckily that company was there that really helped me get back into the swing of things because my memory was really shaken. A lot of things were shaken. I still couldn't memorize a paragraph to save my soul. I mean, I can tell stories. That part was left.
Yeah.
But I used to be able to memorize huge amounts of text, and now I can't memorize a single paragraph.
Here's a story from Kevin Kling. This was aired in January of 2002.
I'm sitting in the coffee shop, slowly digging out bus change and laying it carefully on the table. It's a strange-looking ritual, but ever since my motorcycle accident, my right arm is paralyzed. My other arm has always had a congenital condition, and it's much shorter, a bit crooked, and no thumb. So now my arms work like Lenny and George from Of Mice and Men. One can't catch the rabbits, and the other can't seem to remember the rabbits. It takes all of my concentration to manipulate both a dollar and a quarter, so when the bus comes, I can spring into action. As careful as I am, though, a quarter falls to the floor. Now, if I could take off my shoe and sock, I know I could get it. My feet have become downright prehensile over the past few months. Not that I can deal around a blackjack, and I understand if you don't want me to open your can of Sprite, but I could get this quarter. What is the proper etiquette here? I feel my head getting hot. The people around me are beautiful and healthy and smoking and flirting, and this fuels my frustration. I that am rudely stamped, like Shakespeare's King Richard would say, unfinished, sent before my time into this breathing world, scarce half made up. And since I cannot prove a lover to entertain these fair well-spoken days, I am determined to prove a villain. In other words, sometimes I just lose it. But not today. I let the quarter go. A lot of the folks around me are tattooed and pierced, and I think about getting a tattoo to hide some of my recent scars. I want to get one that says in Gothic letters, "My other body is a weightlifter." The scars are there because I've had a couple of surgeries to fix my brachial plexus. The brachial plexus are the confluence of nerves that connect the spine to the arm, and mine have been pulled out of the spine like a plug out of the socket. Unfortunately, doctors don't know how to plug them back in, but what can be done is the nerves that are already plugged in can be rerouted to the troubled area. In my case, it's taking nerves from the rib area and redirecting them to the bicep and shoulder, or, like my mechanic would say, robbing Peter to pay Paul. I pray that Peter doesn't deny me and Paul establishes a strong foundation, but you never know what'll happen. When my dad used speaker wire to rewire the garage door opener, I remember we ended up parking the car on the street a lot. I read about one guy, for months after his surgery, every time he sneezed, he raised his hand. Well, I've got time to find out what happens. Nerves grow about an inch a month, so it'll be a year or two before I know if the surgery worked. And I have at least one more surgery to go. Each surgery lasts from 18 to 24 hours. So these are extremely focused hours, and these surgeons are like Navy SEALs of their profession. After being under the anesthesia so long, I come out talking like an old Walter Brennan for about 3 weeks. Then I graduate to a young Walter Brennan, then to a Walter Brennan type, to finally sounding like myself. During this time, I watch a lot of nature shows and cooking shows on TV. I swear there's not a white shark in the ocean I don't know by sight. In fact, when I was watching The Iron Chef the other day, I thought I recognized some of the ingredients. During this time, people stop by, friends who've cooked a meal. Sometimes people bring their kids for a visit, but I know afterward they're in the car saying, "See what'll happen if you get on a motorcycle."
It's Kevin Kling from an essay he wrote, in the months really after.
That was right after, yeah. Man, my voice.
What do you think when you hear that?
It's wild here now. I mean, I was intubated. You know, they had pipes down me. So, yeah, it was a while to get my voice back. And I was in between surgeries. That was interesting, too. That caught me right in between two major. These surgeries are incredible. What they open you up, and it's a 20-some-hour surgery.
You know, I was thinking also that, I mean, this was in the, like a month later. I mean, you, I don't even know how, if you were aware that 9/11 happened.
Yeah, that was, I saw it on TV and I thought it was a regular show on TV. I didn't even know it was, because I was in rehab at that, I was in still in the hospital. And my wife called me and said, did you see what happened on TV? And I said, no, even though I had. What I found really, while I was going through post-traumatic stress at the time, after this accident, and I watched the nation have the same symptoms going from denial to anger to vengeance. And it was like we were working through two separate forms of post-traumatic stress at the same time, one a cultural one and one a personal one.
You wrote a play that dealt with trauma, if I'm right, or you've thought a lot about it.
There's been a few, yeah.
So how have you dealt with this question of, I mean, is that the way you cope with it, writing it or telling a story or working with it?
For me, once you can write about something, it doesn't control you anymore. It's one of the reasons I'm a storyteller. When you can tell a story about something, it's already in your vernacular. It's through your way of seeing the world. And so it doesn't control you, these things that are larger than us. I think that's why our stories are so important and why they talk about things that are larger than us. Where do we come from before life? Where do we go after life? What's sacred? What's funny? Our stories really are how we deal with things that are larger than ourselves. And this was a case of something larger than myself.
Kevin Kling is with us. His books are The Dog Says How and Holiday Inn. His new children's book is called Big Little Brother. Take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Kevin Kling is with us, storyteller. So I wanted to ask you about – it's, you know, one thing I've detected, there's this theme. I don't know. Maybe it's not a theme, but there's the story you tell about you and your brothers learning taxidermy.
Mm-hmm.
And like the essence of the way this – I can't even – what's the guy's name that taught you?
Mr. Damjanovich.
Yeah. But his method to teach you was love.
Yeah.
Like – and it seems like love is a theme.
It is
the
theme. Oh man, you're nailing it. Because this, I think, every good story is a love story.
Huh.
I met this wonderful native flute player, and he said every song is a love song, and he didn't know what that meant until he had a daughter, and then he said, "Now I get it." And he played the song on his flute for his daughter, and when he said that, I thought, you know, every good story is a love story. And so I think that's true, and it can be love of so many different things. But if you go at a story that way, it's going to be a way better story.
Mm. I want to have you read a story about Larry.
Oh yeah.
You have it there in front of you. And I have to say, I think there's love in this story as well. I mean, it's such a beautiful, I have to say, for me, moment. You want to say anything about it, or should you just read it?
Larry was a guy at this at the Uptown where I used to go. It was this kind of a diner bar restaurant, and Larry was always there. He was one of those guys. Let's see if it's even in here. He was like, I would go there. He was always there. You couldn't go there without seeing Larry. Except one day I walked in and he wasn't there, and yeah. That's what this story's about. Yeah. I actually saw him outside once. It was 2 p.m. It was like the sun was trying to kill him. You wanted to bring him inside and breathe smoke on him until you got him in the building. But yeah, this is the story of Larry, and this is going to be rare because I don't think I've told this. One Saturday, I walked into the Uptown Bar. When I entered, something was off. I could even tell before my eyes adjusted. Then it slowly took form. Larry was nowhere in sight. So I asked the bartender, and he said Larry was never in the bar on Saturday afternoons anymore. Well, I asked where Larry went, and the bartender said he didn't know, but he did know Larry would be back about 4 or 5. So I waited, and sure enough, Larry comes into the bar around 5 o'clock, and I go, "Well, Larry, where you been?" He says, "I was sitting with the cows." I go, "Larry, why are you sitting with the cows? He said, to ask their forgiveness. Why do you need forgiveness from cows? Then he told me, whatever stories you've heard about a meat processing plant, they're true. The conditions are deplorable. Floors and floors dedicated to the transformation of animals to meat. What arrives on hoof leaves in plastic. But what's impossible to describe is the odor, the rich, thick odor. It's not a bad smell, but it's so thick at first it makes you sick, not from the smell, but from the thickness. But after a time, you get to craving that smell. You can't wait to get to the plant to breathe that air. It feeds you, and all other air becomes insufficient. Larry said, I worked at that plant for 5 years, but you have to be very, very careful. A person can get used to almost anything. A while back, I quit and started visiting the cows on Saturdays and asking their forgiveness. I asked, well, what do the cows do? He said, mostly they lay around, but you'd be surprised how forgiving they can be. So we ordered some beers, and he said, we need nature to sustain and forgive. And then the news came on.
It's a great story.
Oh, thanks. I got to tell you, I was sitting with Larry one time watching the news, and this guy comes on from International Falls, Minnesota, and he goes, yeah, he says, 50 years ago, I moved up here for arthritis, and this year I finally got it. that's why that news part's in there, because Larry and I just busted a gut.
When you are telling a story, like, do you conceive of it? Is it a performance? Is it that, or does it have to be more organic? I mean, and how do you get ready for it? Is it the same way an actor prepares?
No, because you've got to be ready to go in and be open to wherever the audience takes you. So that kind of preparation, it is a really – it's a more malleable form. I love theater, and I'm still very involved in theater and playwriting, and I love the structure of theater. But when you go to a play, it's like a voyeurism. I mean, you're looking into the lives of other people. You're peering through a window. But when you're a storyteller, you're invited into somebody's living room. Mm-hmm. So they're two really different – when you brought up earlier about the exchanges of energy,
it's a
very, very different world, very different skills involved. So
you don't always know where you're going necessarily?
No. You learn a lot. I think why storytellers get better with age. It's one of those occupations that actually the older you get, actually the better you get at, because the really good ones and they, again at Tempanogos, you'll see these guys. They come in with a kind of a game plan, but they're going to be ready to switch gears at any moment. And you can see them do it when you've been in it long enough, and it's a joy to behold. It's incredible.
How do you know when it's working? Like how do you know? This is the conditions are perfect. How can you tell?
You can feel it in the room. Oh man, you can really feel it. And there's nothing like it. I mean, you've been in an event and you were either there or you weren't. And when you were there, that's the thing that I love about storytelling, is that if you were there, you never forget it. You will remember that with other people for the rest of your life. And you can see people looking at each other, because even though it is an exchange of energy back and forth, it's a communal sense. It's an event and it's a ritual all at the same time. And when it clicks, it's something you will never forget.
I wanted to ask about the children's book. What made you think you wanted to do that? And what was the experience like?
I've written a lot of kids' theater, yeah. And I've written a lot of adaptations of Lily's Purple Plastic Purse. I got to do that, and Lyle the Crocodile, and some of these that have toured the country. And so I've loved to write for kids. And then this story came up about my brother, that this is the perfect form for it, and it's a picture book. So, because it's a really short episode of when I got dropped off at one of those places that'll watch your kids while your mom shops. And so my mom would drop me off, and my brother was too little, so she would take him. Actually, my brother was bigger than me, though. He was 2 and I was 4, and he'd already outgrown me.
Right.
And everyone thought he had anger issues, but he didn't, because he would like so worry. He would grab the first donut he'd see every morning and he would hold them in his hand. So it looked like he had fists all day and he was angry, but they were donuts. So, and at night he'd fall asleep and these crumbs would fall out. And so my mom dropped me off and this kid and I got in a fight over a plastic turkey. And the next thing I know, there was my brother with his fists of donuts standing there and chased the kid away. So my mom left him there from then on. And that became this picture book. And this woman, Chris Monroe, this illustrator, she's unbelievable. She did a monkey with a tool belt. I don't know if you've ever seen it. It's a brilliant book. And so she's the illustrator. So she's incredible.
So when, do you conceive of the age of an audience when you're telling a story? Do you have to sort of direct it to kids or direct it to adults?
Yeah, you really do take into account where you are, who's in the audience, what happened that day. You know, it's a lot of factors go into play. Because when you're a storyteller, you are invited in. There's an element of trust you've got to establish if you want a story to work. And so you really got to respect who you're talking to, who's in the audience, because you do want to establish a level of trust, because later on you'll ask for something from them. You'll ask them to go somewhere they weren't prepared to go, and there needs to be a level of trust so that they'll go there.
Do you worry, Kevin Kling, about, you know, everyone's so stressed out about what digital technology is going to mean for certain forms. You know, what's it going to mean for the book, and what's it going to mean for journalism? Do you worry about storytelling?
You know, I do, but then I'll go teach in a school and I'll work with students and I'll think, okay, let's see what technology has done. And then they tell these amazing stories. And I always leave just on cloud nine whenever I teach, because I realize that it's deeper than technology. Whatever storytelling is so much deeper than this patina of technology. So
it's embedded deep in us.
It is. It must be, because students can still, even students that are really techno, you know, really into it.
Which all of them are nowadays.
They are. But, you know, when you set them down and get them in a room telling stories, they can really whip it up. Yep. I always leave just happy as can be.
I want to ask you about this story that you tell. I'm going to have you read this a section here, because it really gets at this idea of how your story's changed after the accident. And the way you sort of tell it in this particular story is how your prayers changed. Set this up for us, because you talk about how your prayers kind of shifted. I mean, like at the beginning when you were praying, you know, you like any kid, you prayed for the
– prayed to get stuff.
Get stuff, like the spider monkey.
It is. I'd be in the car on the way to my grandparents for Christmas, and I'd pray to God to ask Jesus to tell Santa to bring me a spider, you know, a squirrel monkey out of Spider-Man. I mean, it was just what you did. And so you'd pray to get things. And then my second phase of prayer was to get me out of things. You know, those were the prayers were usually in college, was please get me out of this.
Yeah.
And then they shifted one more time after my accident. And that's when you're referring to, I think.
Yeah.
Oh, and so this is after the motorcycle accident. I've been through many surgeries. I'm in the hospital a little over 6 weeks. Each day I ride the elevator to the ground floor and try to take a walk. I'll go maybe half a block. At this same time, 9/11 happened. And as our country was entering trauma, I was living one. I already knew you can't cure a trauma, but hopefully in time you can heal from it. But it does take time. I was on the elevator. Wait a minute. I got to switch this up. I know this is not in the book, but there's a funny story here.
Go for it.
I'm on the elevator.
This is what makes you a good storyteller.
Well, I'm on the elevator, and this kid gets on. He was probably 8 years old, and I'm riding the elevator down. And he points to the back of his head, and he goes, I had to get 8 stitches here. I hit my head on a fence post. And I'm like, oh, yeah? I had to get stitches from here to here. I go ear to ear. I say, well, down one arm, down one leg to the floor. And the kid looks at me and goes, yeah, but mine really hurt. And I'm like, man, you can't judge another man's pain, you know? And so I get to the bottom floor. Okay, now we're back into this. I get to the bottom floor. I take my half a block walk. And Mary, my girlfriend's waiting for me at the gift shop. And she asked if I wanted an apple. She said, these look really good. Now, I haven't tasted food in over a month. I had no taste, so I'm losing a lot of weight. But she persisted. She said, come on, try it, please, for me. So I took a bite, and for some reason, that was the day flavor returned. It rushed into my mouth, and as it rushed in, I started to cry for the first time in years. And these tears flowed out, and as they did, the anesthesia and antibiotics flushed through my tears, and it burned my eyes. And between the sweetness of that apple and the burning in my tears, it felt so good to be alive. I blurted out, thank you, thank you, thank you for this life. And that's when my prayers shifted to prayers of thanks. And I don't know whether good things started happening because I was saying thanks or I was just noticing him more, but blessings started to emerge from the curses. For one thing, people help me every day. And I have to tell you, nobody looks better than when they're helping somebody. So sometimes I'll be sitting at home with Mary. We'll be in front of the fireplace and we got our two wiener dogs sitting there. We got a basset hound now. When we got him from the trainer, that we got him at 10 weeks, she said. When it comes to training a basset hound, they start out slow and then they taper off.
And it's totally, I have to say I wrote that down.
It's true. So we'll be sitting there. It's snowing out because it's Minnesota. And I'll take a moment to pray to God, to ask Jesus to tell Santa, if there's one thing I want, it's to say thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Or a squirrel monkey.
You know, in one story you tell, you describe having a disability as kind of like having a foot in two different worlds.
Yeah.
And in some ways you talk about how even the accident and the experience of having a disability, it's like you felt like a ghost.
Yeah, that's true. A guy who saw the accident. I still run into this guy. He saw me have the accident, and he was so sure that I died that he decided I died. He told all of our friends that I died. And even since then, I still see him on the bus, but I can't convince him I'm alive. He still thinks I'm a ghost. He won't even talk to me. I'll talk to him, and he looks like through me. He thinks I've been sent to haunt Minneapolis. And I don't entirely disagree with him. It's like I still don't feel like I'm all the way back. I'll always feel like I've got a foot in two worlds. It's true.
You know, you write about the underworld. I love it how you put this. You said it's like a good haircut. It falls somewhere between something I have and something I wanted.
That's just a guess.
Of course. I mean, we talked about the accident, how, you know, this idea of you feeling this peace and having this decision you had to make, mm-hmm. you know, and not like you couldn't have made a wrong decision. You could have gone either way, mm-hmm. but for some reason you returned here. But you say in the book that you haven't completely returned,
mm-mm.
that you can't completely return.
No, I don't know why that is, but there will always be a foot already waiting to go. Part of that, though, is it really feeds into the I don't fear death anymore. There's something that has been erased from the fear of death. I'm not ready to go, and I don't want to go, but I still have more to do here. But that really did erase that fear of what's to come.
So what do you figure is to come?
I don't know.
Does it matter?
To me, I mean, it's beyond it. It's like try to tell a baby before it's born what this world is like. It would be impossible. It's terms that can't be understood until you live this world of senses, this visceral existence. And the whatever's to come has got to be on that a level of that, of something we probably can't put into words, something beyond what we can understand is what I'm guessing. Still, it's still, I don't know, you know, it's a big what, you know, something.
You've talked about three books you wanted to write. You wanted to three books. I remember mm-hmm. this is a while back. So what else do you want to write? Do you know?
There's a book I want to write on the Fourth Holy Crusade. It was an amazing time, 1204. Incredible. It was all the ingredients to the stew for the Renaissance, but nobody had made the stew yet. Wow. So there's all these ingredients running around, and it's a really – and they were clashing. Nobody knew what to do with them, you know. And And so it's a really exciting time in history. And it's really the parallels with now are incredible, and with the Fourth Crusade and with our recent ventures into the Mideast. I think that there's so many wonderful parallels there.
So you've got a lot going on still.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, yeah. Too much in a really good way.
Yeah. So what does it mean if you don't have the fear of death anymore? Is that a burden?
No.
It frees you.
It really does. Yeah. That's not an issue anymore. And so many people arrive at it from different ways. I mean, or not. You know, it's still – and in fact, if my wife hears this, we'll get a huge talk about this one because we're really on different – Yeah, and I'm not expecting people to, you know – to jump aboard as to where I came, you know, how I came to this. It's a very personal experience. Yeah. But you can arrive through it so many different ways, you know, through faith or family or community, or there's a lot of ways to arrive at peace.
Kevin Kling, his stories are collected in the books The Dog Says How and Holiday Inn. His children's book, Big Little Brother, is due out in November. Radio West is a production of KUER News. For links to resources mentioned on today's program or to continue the conversation on our online discussion board, go to our website at KUER.org. Radio West is directed by Mike Anderson, produced by Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.